Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. At the second annual John Wilmerding Symposium on American Art held on March 23, 2018 at the National Gallery of Art, Janine Antoni, Byron Kim, and Glenn Ligon, whose works are featured in the special installation Bodies of Work, discussed their art with Molly Donovan. The conversation rounded out the symposium's focus on portraiture and the histories and processes of representing the human figure in the nation's collection. The John Wilmerding Symposium on American Art is made possible by a grant from the Walton Family Foundation.
So I'm Molly Donovan, and with me are Glenn Ligon, Janine Antoni, and Byron Kim. And before we get started, I first want to take a moment to thank our sponsor, our funder, the Walton Foundation, our great namesake honoree, John Wilmerding, all the participants today, some of whom have traveled from far to be with us and to present their ideas and give us their knowledge, and all my colleagues here at the National Gallery who have worked very, very hard to bring together today's program. And in particular, I want to call out Allie Peel. So now back to the artists and the reason why we are all at an art museum. If it weren't for them, we would not be here. For the work that they do and that they give us all the time. And on the screen behind me, you can see in the top is Byron Kim's Synecdoche from 1991 to the present. Janine Antoni's Lick and Lather in the bottom left. It comprises 14 self-portrait busts, 7 in chocolate and 7 in soap. The chocolate she licked and the soap bust she bathed with, so this act of self-erasure. And on the bottom right, 2 self-portraits by Glenn Ligon, which came to us from the Corcoran Collection. We're very lucky to add them to our collection of Ligons. Self-portrait 8 on the left and 10 on the right, both from 1996. And these works are on view in the upper level gallery that Terrence so kindly called out in an installation of the permanent collection entitled Bodies of Work. It's an installation of the permanent collection that reimagines, shows how artists are reimagining the human form as a site of fantasy, fear, and travail, and they demonstrate the ways that contemporary artists grapple with the many different ways that the body has figured in the history of art and in the broader narratives. And as the critic Britt Julius reminds us, art is as much about labor as it is about interpretation. So the process of making that goes into a body of work by an artist. And this term and these works provide a framework for understanding. These particular artists were the inspiration for this installation, and their works anchor a subset within bodies of work that focuses on portraiture, and that is the subject of a focus of today's symposium. So they, by extension, have provided the inspiration for our program today. So thank you. This is the capstone of a long day, and we're grateful that you are all here to join us. But it's also the capstone of a project that began many years ago here at the gallery to add the watershed works by each one of these artists to the National Gallery's collection. So it's extremely gratifying. Not only to have the works on view, but to have these artists here today. As I understand it, and you're going to have to correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe this is the first public program where all three of you have appeared. Is that right?
I can't remember.
I don't know.
Sounds plausible.
Yeah, it sounds right.
And and this is not a random thing, because these are, you've been in print together. Connie Llewellyn's interview with from Eugenie's book. But they share a studio building. They see one another almost daily when they are in New York working. And so they have this synecdochical relationship. And I think it's remarkable, Glenn.
Oh, and I was just going to say, we're in the same studio building. We don't share it, in that we don't own it. New York real estate, okay. But we are literally down the hall from one another.
Fine point of distinction, absolutely.
And we've been together for, I just found out by researching it in these paintings that I make every week, since 2002, so that's...
But I was there before you guys were there.
Just a little bit.
So I learned to ride a bike in that space before your studios were built. Anyway,
we've been there for 15 or 16 years together, and it makes me almost want to cry, but Janine is leaving in a month. Anyway.
So this is a really historic moment, I must say.
Because of rent, actually.
Kickstarter.
I just want to just talk about for a second the fact that each of your practices is very distinct, and yet you share certain characteristics, and maybe through the studio building walls. Your works are all intertextual and discursive. They're specific and open, both in the release of a powerful combination of American cultural legacies and the struggles of the self as representational, and the self and the group. And they're all representational, abstract, and conceptual. So I wanted to take the idea of bodies of work and share it with them, and what they did with this idea, in which they served for the inspiration, was to give it some shape, the presentation today. And each one chose one work from the beginnings of their career, and in this case, three works that were in the beginning point will be the Whitney Biennial from 1993, and then a work from the middle part of their career, and then a more recent work. So that's how the format will go. So as this chosen starting point from 1993, the Whitney Biennial, Byron shared a clip from a really interesting video that was made at the time by a group of high school students that were brought together by the Educational Video Center in New York City. And I want to call out the Educational Video Center director and one of the students who helped make the movie, the film, 25 years ago, who are here. So please raise your hands. Thank you. We're delighted you were able to join us, and thank you for sending us the full documentary from which we made a clip that we're going to show you now from the Whitney Biennial, where these students are interviewing the artist to try and understand and come to terms with this exhibition. Roll it, please. Thank you.
Janine and Tony, for instance, choose a huge box of chocolate and garlic in her work.
And what is that?
What's that?
Yeah.
These are the bites.
Oh. You pick them off the floor, or do you catch them?
I spit them out.
Oh.
And this is what I melted. I put this in, melted in a double boiler.
Chocolate that I spit out, I cast into these heart-shaped packaging for chocolate candy. The lipstick is made from lard, and I mixed it with pigmented beeswax and cast it into this form of 300 lipsticks. I am the source for my work, so it's very much about women. The eating disorders is also something that affects us all, but particularly women. And the idea of image making, that, you know, that women are particularly aware of their image, and that is what sort of maybe causes things like eating disorders.
So are you saying something about feminism, or you think it's wider than that?
You know, at one level I am, and I hope that it extends beyond that.
The inspirations and materials used by the artists in the show came from many different places, mm-hmm. but they were all commenting on life in America. Byron Kim was obsessed with the paint and the color of people's skin.
Yeah, it's more peachy, right? It's funny, my mom calls every once in a while and either talks to me or my wife, and she's worried because she thinks I only have one idea. She calls it and says, she asked me to list my ideas and just the skin thing. I just did this mural up in the new museum of my own skin color that they paint. And she said, my mom said, why don't you pick your color? Why didn't you pick your sister's color? You're so dark. Basically, there's this ridiculous aspect to this project, or to making painting so minimal that there's something funny about it. I don't talk about that often, but that's definitely part of it. It's not like ha-ha funny, but I think that to me sometimes the just barely funny is really funny.
They were making bodies all over the wind. Well, my thoughts installation used Robert Mapplethorpe's photographs to explore questions of sex, stereotypes, and homophobia.
These men depicted on the wall are me on some level, you know, or could be me, or could be related to me, or people that I know. I don't think there is such a thing as pure beauty, you know, or ideas of beauty. I mean, especially, you know, talking about representations of black men have never really been thought of in dominant culture as beautiful, you know, black people historically have not been thought of as beautiful. So, I mean, already that tells you that ideas of sort of beauty are bound by the culture, don't exist in the sort of absolute space. So I think what's interesting about the work that I'm seeing in Biennial is that it really does force people to think about what role art might play, that art is not necessarily something that's gonna, like, make your eye rest, that the art is really about making your head work. Which isn't to say that things shouldn't be beautiful, but I think we're just at a point where that's not enough.
Okay, Glenn.
Mm. Ooh.
Just.
Yeah. Well, this, it's very interesting to see those clips, because I don't know if can be so articulate about this project now, but it seemed on film I was very, you know, very articulate about what I was doing. But it's interesting over time, your perception of what a piece is or what the motivations were behind it change. I mean, this piece basically, to start, I would say all my works is quotation in one form or another, text-based paintings that have quotes from authors in it. And this project, Notes on the Margin of the Black Book, I saw as an extension of that, in that it uses images from Robert Mapplethorpe's Black Book, which is a collection of 91 or 93, 91 images of black men that he's taken and collected in a book. It was never an exhibition. It was simply a collection of his photographs of a particular subject matter. And the work sort of operated in the context, for me, of work I sort of felt like I had to go through in order to talk about black bodies, black masculinity, black sexuality. This is the work that was being shown, celebrated in the museum exhibitions and gallery exhibitions. This is the work that was being debated in the halls of Congress in terms of questions of censorship and homophobia and government funding of the arts. And so I felt like I kind of had to take it on in some ways. And so the piece became this presentation of the photographs that Mapplethorpe took, cut directly from the Black Book, and then a collection of quotes, way too small to read in these images, though I'll read one of them, one or two of them here. I have the text. Collected from a huge variety of sources, people I interviewed about these photographs, commentators that were talking directly about the photographs, like bell hooks, or the poet Essex Hemphill, people who objected to the photographs, right-wing commentaries, art critics, models who'd sat for the photographs. So the idea was to create this sort of huge kind of anthology, if you will, of ideas about these kinds of representations. Okay, this is from Stuart Hall. The way in which black people, black experiences, were positioned and subjected in the dominant regimes of representation were the effects of a critical exercise of cultural power and normalization. Not only in Said's Orientalist sense were we constructed as different and other within the categories of knowledge of the West, but, constructed as different and other within the categories of knowledge of the West by those regimes. They had the power to make us see and experience ourselves as other. And then sort of from the maybe the opposite side of the spectrum. In a constitutional democracy, anything may be possible, but I thought Mapplethorpe went too far, trying to justify his own inclinations. It's unfortunate that a talented human being would engage in that. He asked for it by going overboard. And that was from Walter Annenberg, who was our ambassador to the court of St. James, UK, during the Nixon administration. So every kind of position in between those two was represented in this piece.
So this is this work that I made starting in the 90s, early 90s, 1991, and it continues. It keeps getting bigger. It's called synecdoche, which is a term of grammar, which means it's a kind of metaphor, a part standing for the whole. And it's simply a collection of small 10-by-8-inch oil paintings of people's skin color, done from observation, as you could tell from the clip, the YoTV clip. And this is as it was installed in the 93 biennial. And I think there
275
elements, and it's gotten bigger. I'm really especially grateful that it eventually came to reside here at the National Gallery for a number of reasons, but one is that it keeps getting bigger, and the two main reasons I'm so grateful is that the audience to this museum is particularly diverse audience, and secondly, the painting has been up for a long time instead of being in storage most of the time. So one of the advantages of having it up so frequently and so accessible is that I get these selfies sent to me pretty frequently. So that's my friend Victoria Fu and her parents. That's Lucas, Suzanne McClellan's son, Tom Parada, my a novelist and my college roommate, Adeline Kim, who's sitting over there, is my youngest child, our youngest child, Emmett, her older brother. And that was the other installation. This is the current, a depiction of the current installation here upstairs, but the one that Emmett was standing in front of was the previous one.
Which was, when it came to the into the collection, it was 429 panels, and it's now 560.
560?
Yeah.
I thought it was closer to 500. And here are two selfies of artists who are particularly dear to me. Oh, I thought Glenn was inserted in there.
I'll take that one.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't know if you got it from that small video, but this is 600 pounds of chocolate that I chewed on for a month and a half. Same mold now, 600 pounds of lard that I also chewed on. And then the material I spit out from those forms, I made the heart shape packaging for chocolate candy. And the lard that I spit out, I mixed with pigment and beeswax and made these lipstick and then created a display to put them in. And there's many things to say about this, but I'm so happy I got to be in the middle here because I feel like the one thing about making work side by side is that you kind of look at your peers through the periphery, and that's really how the creative process works, and influence comes in from the periphery, and there's being between these two made me think about this piece in two ways. One is how this work has to do with desire, both the need to be desired and having desires like chocolate. And thinking about Glenn's work and thinking about, does desire always come with objectification? So I think that's really an important topic in the work. And the other thing that is important to say is Byron's use of the monochrome and my use of the cube and, thinking about minimalism and how it was so ubiquitous that it cut out any possibility of any other forms. I hope people look back at our generation and say that was the generation of pluralism and a place of possibility of form. But minimalism was easy to make fun of. Because it did that to itself. I just wanted to quote Felix. I'm going to do a really bad job of it, but my favorite interview is between Tim Rollins and Felix. And Felix talks about how he took a form that was sanctioned by art history, something that looked like art, and he infected it from the inside. And infect was a good word for Felix. He said that, marginal people stay on the margins and put waves into the center, but he wanted to locate himself at the center and corrupt it from that place. So that, I took that to heart with Na.
I just want to, what I'm hearing and seeing is this reference in each of your works in the Whitney Biennale to art history, to Mapplethorpe's exhibition and reception, minimalism, monochrome painting, portraiture. So I'm just wondering if you can kind of address that as an idea, art history, and why it was so meaningful in this moment, and why, for those who don't know about the 93 Whitney Biennial, it was
you know, excoriated. It was really attacked, and only over time have critics come to eat their words that they wrote back then, and have people come to understand its incredible importance, and it is now deeply understood and widely appreciated as one of the most important exhibitions of the recent 50 years.
Oh, I was just going to briefly say that I think the Felix Gonzalez Torres quotation that Janine just made really gets to it. You know, we all sought to take art history, either very recent art history or distant art history. This isn't our only strategy, but one of them was to take it and try to explode it in order to move forward at that point in the early 90s.
I think maybe for me it was more about something on the lines of what Felix meant was like inhabiting something that already looked like art. I remember I was just talking about this to someone the other day about this piece, Notes on the Margin, and one of the critics that wrote about that show said, Glenn Ligon is a closet formalist, looking at this piece. And I thought, yes, exactly. But I know what they meant was art by colored folks is supposed to be messy. Because if you think about it, why you know, everything is formal, you know? But what he meant was, like, I didn't know someone like you could do that. And I think that's kind of what's in Felix's quote about inhabiting, you know, a sanctioned form of, this looks like art, except it's contaminated with the social. You know, it's my boyfriend's weight. You know, it's contaminated with the sentimental, with the world, basically. And that's kind of that taking on of that form, I think, was really important for me in terms of that piece.
Yeah, I think it's a kind of locating of oneself, a holding ground. I belong here. I'm going to be in dialogue with this thing. I used to say that the bite summed up my relationship to art history. It's both intimate and aggressive. That art history made me as an artist and excluded me as a woman.
One thing that's just occurring to me now, which is very obvious, is that to use minimalism or the grid in order to and sort of adulterate it in this way is kind of an easy thing to do, but it makes the most sense in a way, because at that point in art history, when minimalism was ascendant, it seemed that everything was sort of coming to a point or an end. I'm thinking of Reinhardt, the implications of Reinhardt's work the most, even though peaks in a way sort of preceded high minimalism. I guess that's my point. I think I had more of a point, but I lost my train of thought. I probably would have been able to complete that thought when I was in my 20s, but 30s, but maybe not.
Well, I think it speaks to this idea of the opening, the discursive in each of your works. You know, it's the question that Terrence was talking about, the body's question, this interrogation, this you know, exercise of you know, broadening, not constricting, which goes to some of the questions that some of the our audience was asking. What is art? You know, it's about the broadening definition of art and not the constricting definition of art. So,
should we go to the second round?
Yeah, yeah. And the next one is.
Much more tension if I could walk along the rope and as it dipped, but just for a moment, I would touch the horizon.
Yeah, so that...
I'm imagining that's from Art 21 and not from the piece itself. The piece itself is just me walking on the tightrope, and every once in a while when I get to the edge of the screen, I disappear, and then you're left with just the horizon, and then I walk across again. And that horizon is probably the thing that I looked at most in my life. I could see it from my bedroom. And my mom used to tell me this thing when I was a little girl. She'd say, "Janine, go out and see the world, because this place we come from is behind God's back." And that's a kind of Caribbean saying, which really means that we come from this little island that nobody really cares about. And so I would look out at that horizon and imagine the world out there. But the horizon is a funny thing. It's not really a place. The closer you get to it, the more it recedes. So I decided at some point that that line, that horizon, was really the space of my imagination, and that I wanted to balance in that place. So in order to do that, I had to learn to tightrope walk. And when I learned to tightrope walk, I learned many lessons from learning about balance. But the most interesting one was that I could stay on the rope better and better when I felt more comfortable with being out of balance. That when I was uncomfortable with being out of balance, I would overcompensate and be off the rope in a second. So I guess I'm thinking about that view and how the horizon is one of those places, kind of like the night sky or the sky in itself, that I have two feelings when I look out at those kinds of awe-inspiring places. The feeling of being really small and insignificant, and at the same time, the feeling of being totally interconnected. And so I'm interested in that imaginative space that it creates for me, and how liberating that space can be. So on a personal level, it definitely has to do with where I come from and where I wanted to go. And then on another level, it's about nature and the sublime and hope, I guess.
And that was made about almost 10 years after Gnaw.
Really?
2002.
Okay.
Yeah, it's called Touch. So just to give an idea of the span and the space between the two works.
Right, and I should say that it was made so that when I lined up the tightrope, that the weight of my body just brought me to that moment. So it's really about all of us waiting for me to walk on the horizon, and knowing that that can only last for a second, but how we collectively wait for that kind of illusion.
I started a series of paintings using a text by James Baldwin in 1996. The essay that Baldwin wrote was called Stranger in the Village. It was written in the early 50s. It's about many things, but primarily it's about his encounter with a small Swiss mountain village in the 50s. He's gone there to write a novel. He's staying in the chalet of his lover's family. And he says in the essay that for many of the inhabitants, he's the first Black person they've seen. And there's a kind of fascination with him as a figure. And he sort of goes on in that essay to talk about what it means to be another, what it means to have a relationship that the villagers have to European culture and history, and his relationship to it. He talks about how the villagers see him as Africans, because black people come from Africa, not from America. The image of America that is whiteness, not blackness, as it is now. But I really got fascinated in the essay because it is about, in a way, a kind of density and opacity and an inability to be read. And the paintings became sort of more and more, you can see one of them, black on black, using just oil stick at first, and then oil stick and coal dust, this sort of shiny waste material from coal processing. And so they have this text in them from Baldwin's essay, but very, very dense and very difficult to read. And that kind of staging of the difficulty in the paintings was about, it seemed to me, what Baldwin was talking about, this desire that he has through the writing of this essay to be in touch, basically, to explain himself, to explain himself to the world, to understand this sort of question of otherness, but also for me, the difficulty of that, how language doesn't quite work for that, you know, how there's a kind of failure to that. So this oscillation, I think, between this sort of legibility and opacity, you know, density of the material, but then the density of the material makes it unreadable. And sort of this oscillation between. But it was interesting when Janine was talking about this sort of sense of going out. When I think about it, Baldwin had to leave America, really, to find himself as a writer. So there is this sense of one has to go towards the other, you know. He put himself in a position to, in order to become, put himself in a position of difficulty in order to become the writer that he became. But he was also very deeply interested in America as a project and used this kind of otherness, this sort of self-exile as a way to look at American society and try to understand it and explain it through his novels and essays.
So since, so this is an installation view of a recent gallery show of these little paintings that I've been making since January 7th, 2001. And here's the one that I made that day, January 7th, 2001. I don't know if I can read. Oh yeah. Clear, snow melting, dripped into the painting every Sunday, ? Byron Kim, I signed it on the front. 7 January 2001. So every week since then, I've made a little painting of the sky and then written a kind of diary entry on the face of it. In the beginning, I guess I was afraid to actually put the writing on the painting itself, so it was relegated to this space in the bottom. Eventually, I began to write the words directly on the painting. And since I've done that since then till now, I think, you know, I think there are more of them. Well, there definitely are more of them than there are skin paintings, because I think there are over 800 now. So there are just a couple examples of them, but I was leafing through my little log of the writings, and I just, it's not these two that I'm depicting here, but a couple that I just ran across because I've been traveling and I couldn't get the images of these two, but I thought I'd read the writing from just two of them. So 3-18-01, 6:15 a.m., 760 Chestnut Street, San Francisco. Looking out over the bay, fog rolling in from Marin, Janine and I are on our way to Green Gulch Farm Zen Center, 2 weeks teaching at San Francisco Art Institute. And then the second one is 11-18-02, 4 p.m., Greenpoint. I'm obsessed with finding a new studio. Started making text paintings today. Now I know why Glenn thought they ought to have color, not black and white. Saw Glenn today. He showed me an old painting, all white, that repeated, I was somebody. I noticed one mistake. I am somebody, a fortuitous mistake. This Saturday, Glenn has his first dinner party. So.
Last.
First and last. And actually, Phyllis, do you remember that? That was that, yeah. That was that.
Oh my God. Yeah, cooking the steaks on the George Foreman grill.
Yes.
Yeah, there's several in that second. So the first quotation is about a moment in a very rich and long friendship. But that second quotation, I was reading it, and there's so much about it that makes no sense to me. Like, I was making, I think I vaguely remember trying to make text paintings at a certain point, and Glenn kind of, I think he was polite enough and kind enough not to be too skeptical. And he clearly had some comment about it, which I don't remember except for having read that. But the strange thing is that I seem to have thought that I was making an attempt at making text paintings at that moment in 2002, but I've been making these paintings since 2001, and it's only in 2018 with this show that I realized that these are text paintings, because somebody said so at the opening. So one thing that I wanted to say about this work in relation to, and it's a kind of reiteration, but what Janine was saying about, you'll be able to say it better because you just said it, but about kind of an insignificant or a little life or a moment in a life and then trying to connect with everything. That's what this project has always been about. And then I realized at some point that's what my work tends to be about in general. So I think that this grouping of three is very, really very tight in that way.
So just to kind of think about all three of these works together, one idea that comes up for me in all of them, but two different words, two ideas. One is alienation, and one is doubt. And I think that there's a lot of that in all of your works, but in particular in these three. So I'm just curious if you have any thoughts about that. And alienation as an idea, you know, literally like taking away, but also separating out. It has different valences at different times in the history of post-war philosophy, but I think it's making a comeback, alienation might be. And
I wonder why.
And these works aren't from the present, but I think that somehow maybe my present moment, I'm reading that into them. So I'm curious about your thoughts on alien. I mean, certainly Baldwin's, you know, it's a great case of alienation.
It's interesting, though, because I very rarely use my own text, so it's always inhabiting someone else's alienation in some ways, you know, inhabiting someone else's subjectivity to make the work, and kind of this confusion between the two, which I think has some resonance in both of Janine and Byron's project.
I wasn't at first quite understanding how you saw that in these works, but as soon as you said it, I realized that I know just deep inside me that's, for me anyway, there's nothing generative without doubt somehow. And I think it's, this is a little bit too therapeutic, but it's just, I think it's being the child of that mom that I described in that video clip. You know, just being really small, you know, do I have anything to say that's anybody would want to listen to. And so this notion of just being very small in the face of this large universe, it's like when Janine was explaining coming from a small island and trying to engage everybody, it's kind of a daunting proposal.
I mean, oftentimes when you try to look at the self in relationship to the world, it can be alienating. I mean, I think that's what the experience of Baldwin traveling to see himself as American. But something about the two pieces Byron has shown that struck me is that both of them are, maybe this is just because I know Byron well, they're an excuse for relating. And that makes life less alienating. And that, in the end, is probably why we make art, so that someone can say, tell us we're not as strange as we feel.
Well, right, so alienation and then the inalienable, the things, you know, you can't take away from everyone is that we all inhabit a body, the things we share.
Right.
Right, so it's that other side of the social side of that. And these are more recent works. So this
I was just crying. Which I've never done publicly, only alone. So this is kind of weird. It's because I think my wife, Lisa Siegel, who is also an artist, and I have three children, and they finally left. The last one is sitting over there. This is all by way of explaining that I had a show like a year ago and then a few months ago, which never happens. Anyway, this show was on the subject of bruising, and it didn't, there are paintings that don't depict bruises, but they're kind of on that subject. And so here are a few examples. And the way that I got to that subject matter was through this poem, which I don't think I'll read. Maybe I'll read. I'll read the part when I ran across it. So it's this poem by Carl Phillips called Alba Innocence, and I'll just read the part that he's waking up. It's dawn, and he's. He sees his lover next to him. I have to shut my one good eye, and at once the leaves falling, but now blurred, make it possible to see how it happens. A bruise lifting itself over time from the darker blues to slowly something like amber, to at last whatever before the wounding the flesh was, imagining the flesh before or without knowledge. I want to say it is most like song untrained, whose beauty, when it occurs, surprises even itself. But isn't it also more commonly just meat? Or isn't it good soil waiting that does not, cannot know that it is waiting? And it goes on. So when I ran across that passage of that poem, I recognized it as the perfect subject matter for me, and I was thinking of the bruise without any context. And I've done this, made this mistake many times in my painting career, which is to try to focus on something so intently without context that it doesn't work. And sometimes I'll do it for a whole year, and then usually it's Glenn and Lisa who will tell me it's not working and I have to abandon it. In this case, I kept working, and eventually it started to work, and of course it started to work because I gave it a context, which was skin, And the way that I did so was to, very different from the original skin paintings, because the fabric of the painting is very much implicated. So these paintings are made with natural dyes, where I'm unstretching the painting and dyeing it with indigo and sandalwood and gardenia flower and this and that. And then later maybe adding oil with a little bit of ochre pigments to use the earth and iron, which is what gives our blood its color. Anyway, that's enough of an explanation of that body of work.
And what are you using to make on the surface? There's glue?
Well, so if after I've, some of the paintings, like that first one, is just dye, and then the subsequent two paintings, they've been dyed with all these natural dyes, and then sized with hide glue, you know, natural glue, and then painted on, but with a kind of paint that I make myself that's mostly a vegetable oil like walnut, and then with just a tiny bit of ochre, different colors of ochre pigment, and some black pigment, and a little bit of blue, I think.
And Glenn, you included one of Byron's Bruce paintings in your show that you curated in St. Louis recently at the Pulitzer.
Right, a show called Blue Black that was based off of looking at Ellsworth Kelly painting, wall relief of the same name, and trying to think through all the various artists that have used those colors in combination or approach those colors in their work in combination.
And I got to meet Carl Phillips there because he lives in St. Louis. I'd never met him. I'm a big fan of his. And it was really amazing. I asked him to read this poem, and he didn't read the whole poem either. Because he said he didn't like the end of it anymore, so he just read the first half.
You were so alike, even though you had never met.
I know, we were like twins born from different parents.
I think it's Janine's next.
Well, not really. This is Anna Halperin, and this is a lot to explain, but I'm going to try to move quickly. So Anna is a movement maker from the West Coast. She's 97, the huge body of work that deals with racism, healing, specifically AIDS and cancer, community building, and brings dance back to ritual, what it was originally made for. And I've been very blessed to be able to work with her in the past several years. And I want to show you a collaboration we did together. I asked her if she would help me do a retrospective of my work in dance, and she completely ignored me and said, "I know exactly what to do with you, Janine. I want to give you the paper from a piece I made called Parades and Changes. That piece was made when I was 1 year old." And so this is a video projection of that dance when it was first performed in Sweden, projected on crates of my work. So I was really interested in the idea that she could take a piece from so long ago and kind of breathe new life into it through another body. And so I was like, why does she get to do that, and why can't I keep my work alive like that? So I took 37 of my works made over the last 25 years, and I shipped them to the museum. And every time I performed with the paper, I unpacked a work or two, and I let that work inspire the kind of movement I did, so I thought I would show you Lick and Lather since it's here. And I think that one thing that's like floating around in through all of us is this idea of what does the surface have to do with it? And how do you get beyond the surface? Where is identity? It's a big question for me. And so, you know, I washed these heads and licked these, like I tried to take the surface away to somehow get to something more essential. So here I am with the paper, and you know, I've chosen these, many things happen over 45 minutes of this performing just with brown paper. And I chose this work because I was really thinking of the first piece I showed you, Naw. And because I experimented with the paper for several years, certain gestures kind of solidified. One of them was that I would be totally naked, put my bra back on and stuff my bra, which is, you know, I think every little girl does at some point in their life. And, you know, thinking about what it is to have a female body. And then the other thing I did, because I'm oral, is I shoved the paper in my mouth and in every other orifice. And there was a moment when those two gestures came together, that after, you know, stuffing my bra, I silenced myself, and those two things always came together. Talking about having a female body, I had to give birth. So this is a weird kind of projectile birthing, river birth that happened. And, what do I want to say? I'm not going to show a film. I'll show one other image with the group. But what I want to say is that Anna gave me the confidence to, well, she asked me to improvise with the paper, and she understood that I was a maker and that if I just did what I do in the studio in front of people, that it would make a pretty interesting performance. But I had a kind of duet with the paper. The paper had this ability to make image after image after image. And what she really did is she just threw me into my unconscious, and shocking things appeared to me. And it's been one of the greatest gifts I've been given as an artist, that she believed in me, but also gave me, she's not a choreographer that would teach me a step, but she created the conditions for me to find things that I didn't know were there.
And you essentially regenerated the work,
yes.
Her work. But
her own work and my own work. We met in this weird place. And I should say that my work is very indebted to female artists of the 70s, so it's not a surprise that I would find someone of that same generation from dance.
But in terms of your overall body of work, this is a very recent. It was about a year ago. And it's the closest thing to a retrospective, you know. Right?
Right. So it's the way to avoid one.
Right. To regenerate your work.
But to keep the work alive, to go back. And that's what this feels like, too, to be able to talk about the work in relation.
And each one of you have had an opportunity to kind of look back at this point in your career.
It seems like Anna was giving you permission on a number of different levels.
We'll talk about that later.
Oh. Or now. Let's let Glenn go.
Okay. There's a bunch of neons that started in, I don't know when I started doing neons. It was 2000-something. The American neons maybe started in mid-2000s. And I was just thinking about
Do you know my dates?
Well, we moved to the studio in 2002, so you couldn't have been before that.
No, because the neon guys are in the same studio building. Yes, because I walked by their shop for 3 years before I went in. And then I went in and did a tour. And I said something really stupid, but stupid things often launch work. I asked them, what about black neon? And they said, black is the absence of light. And I had to give it to them on that one. But then I thought, but then they thought about it, we thought about it, and they came up with a solution, which is painting a neon tube with black paint on the front. So the light is still there, but it's also eclipsed by this black paint. And that's totally stolen from other artists and advertising and all sorts of things. But all my work is from something, you know? And that word seemed particularly interesting because it's so overloaded and overdetermined, and it seemed a bit outrageous to play with it in this way, you know, just taking the word and flipping it around in Photoshop. And that's actually how this piece came about. I have no Photoshop skills, but I can make things flip horizontally and vertically. And I flipped, you know, in this lettering, American typewriter, flipped the word America, I think accidentally, horizontally. And I'm like, why is the A still the A, but the E is backwards? And bilateral symmetry. And so I thought, oh, it's interesting that these letters are kind of turned towards the wall now. So basically it's one of those neons, if you can imagine, the one on the bottom, if you imagine it flipped. I mean, it's upside down, but you do it in your head. Turn it right side up and then flip it towards the wall, a letter at a time. And you sort of end up with that.
And the title of this work?
Rukin figure. I never know if I'm pronouncing that right.
Perfect.
Which is this figure that you see in, like, Caspar Friedrich paintings of the figure looking out of a landscape and their back is to you. So you're looking at a figure in a painting who is looking out over mostly a landscape, a seascape, and the back is to you. So you're looking at a back figure. And so that's sort of this idea of America both facing you and turning away from you. So
that's a great title. That's what that word means? They have a word for that? That's amazing.
Well, that's funny, because the title came before the piece. I always wanted to do a piece based on that idea, but I don't make that kind of work, basically.
So I had an idea, though, along those lines, that your silkscreen, you know, your self-portrait, is a Rukin figure.
Yeah, but I never thought of it that way. In the same way that Byron said he never thought of them as text paintings, the Sunday paintings, I never thought of it, ever thought of it that way.
That work connects to this.
And then a recent piece is this, which is hard to talk about because I actually haven't even seen it. It just got packed up for a show. Again, it's one of those things where you think of something very obvious that someone has probably done, and you do it anyway. So my neon guy's like, has anyone ever asked you to, you know, make their hands in neon? And they kind of look at me and roll their eyes, like, never. So like, how is that possible? So I actually made that piece, but it wasn't a piece. It was just my hands traced and made in neon, and a small version of them, life size. And then I'm doing a show in Naples and was thinking about various people connected to Naples or connected to Italy and thinking about, you know, sort of the idea of like dealing with the context in which I'm showing in. So going through my head, I was like, oh, Oscar Wilde lived in Naples and, you know, Andy Warhol had an important show in Naples. Joseph Beuys went to Naples over and over again. I'm thinking through all these sort of connections. But I sort of settled on the filmmaker Pasolini,
And in the late 60s, he had this idea for a series of films that would be interconnected, and the title was going to be Notes on a Poem for the Third World. And it was going to be shot in India, Africa, the Arab world, South America, and what he called the Black Ghettos of America. But they were to be interconnected, and it was this way of thinking about how sort of the struggles of, you know, what one might call marginalized people across the world were interconnected, but also connected to an Italian context. And so I love that idea of that project. And so I think of this piece, which doesn't have a title, or its title is Notes on a Poem for the Third World, Chapter One. So it is the first of five neons using hands that are in relationship to this film project that Pasolini never actually completed. He completed sections of it, but he never actually did it. So it's almost like making the sets for this film project. But obviously, you know, I'm thinking about what this image of hands spread out means. In this, you know, this is an image that comes up over and over again on social media, you know, in protests, Black Lives Matter protests. Also, which way are those hands turned? Are they facing the wall? Are they palms out? I'm also was thinking about this. It's in the context of a city that's had a huge, or a country and a city, Naples, that is deemed the other. I remember the first time I went to Italy, I saw a TV program and there were signs in the audience. It was a program about immigration. And I asked a friend, what do the signs say? And he said, the signs say, send them to Naples. So there was this idea of Naples as the other, the place of the other in Italy itself. And I was thinking about that in terms of like the immigration to Naples from Africa and the Middle East and the rightward turn in the politics there. So all of that kind of got drawn into, in a strange way, a piece that had nothing to do with that. It was simply me tracing my hands, but finding a, you were talking about context, finding a, I don't know if that was exactly the word you used, Byron, but like context for something, and suddenly it makes sense.
Well, we're pretty close to wrapping up, but I wanted to ask you if you have things you want to talk about, since we have you three together for this historic moment. And, you know, it's a lot of material to cover, so maybe you didn't get all your thoughts, and I just wanted to offer.
What's going on there, Janine?
I'm removing my skin.
Oh. So right before that, the paper was relatively intact.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk about embodiment. And I feel like it's where we live in a culture that is more and more disembodied, and in the context of the things we've been talking about, I'm wondering what happens to us when we don't live in our bodies, when our bodies are just vehicles for our thinking mind. And how does even looking at work put you back into your body? And why we're so afraid of our bodies? I kind of feel that if we take advantage of our bodies for the sake of our minds, it's not a big leap to take advantage of other bodies, and from there to take advantage of the environment. So that's a thought that has been coming up with many things that we've been saying. What is a body? And a body that has pain and has feelings.
It's interesting to think about that in terms of the show upstairs, but also to think about it in terms of the extraordinary amount of young figurative painters there are, and how important those discussions have been. I'm thinking, obviously, the portraits of the Obamas and how much attention those have gotten in what sometimes, you know, art historians talking about that as a genre, portraiture as a sort of discredited genre. But I think any gallery that I go into, any museum, is really interested in the body and figuration, and particularly artists of color, painters. And really, it's really interesting that it's come back at this moment when this other thing happens, when we seemingly can leave our bodies behind. That's the promise of the technology. And there's this kind of insistence among artists.
It's a really interesting paradox that the next generation is going through and is going to go through. I was asking, you know, we have three kids, and two of them don't know how to drive, and I think one of them may never decide to get a license. But I've been spending a lot of time in California. This is a weird digression, but I've been spending a lot of time in California, and the oldest friend that I have, I've been kind of been friends with him for 56 years. He's talking about his teenage son, and then he happened to mention that he doesn't drive, and I thought, how is that possible? It's possible for a New York teenager not to drive, like in our time, right, and now. But a California teenager, I thought that's impossible. But he said that that's pretty common these days, or at least he knows other, it's not just his kid, and I couldn't get my mind around it. And then I realized he was just telling me, yeah, he you know, playing a lot of video games, and he doesn't need to go out of the house because he meets his friends online. And when he said that, I just realized, wow. I mean, I kind of knew that already, but, you know, I started thinking about self-driving cars, and it's just going to be a completely different world really soon.
Is it the film, the movie WALL-E, where all the bodies are just conveyed around? Is that the right one? I always think about that, how prophetic that was, you know, these bodies are just cruising around on conveyor belts, blobs, not people, you know, kind of the forethought involved in coming up with that creative product. But
I was thinking about the bruise paintings and thinking about how a bruise comes from a strike from the outside, but the bruise itself is coming from the inside out. And again, we're back to that surface. Like, what's the communication that's happening? How does the inside come to meet the outside?
Was that part of the motivation to seek out someone like Anna Halperin to work with?
yeah, but I only figured that out afterwards, that she was giving me something that I didn't have access to. Mm-hmm. You know, what I was thinking about with you saying that, you know, we're back to painting the figure again, and thinking about what bodies do we need to see and how do we need to see them, and what images need to be out there in the world. And that's something that maybe young people can.
Right. Yeah, bodies are not finished business for certain
people.
People. It's not finished.
Well, with that, that's a good place to kind of summarize, I think. And I'm just remembering what my colleague Nancy Anderson was saying about how the National Gallery's policy is to never deaccession. We never let go of a work of art, and we're very, very grateful that your works will never leave our collection. They will always be here. And that idea reminds me of
something that Greg Bordowitz wrote in a book on your painting, I'm a Man painting, in the National Gallery's collection. He wrote, nothing is erased. The process is cumulation. Cumulative. I just botched that one. The process is cumulative. And really, that's what we're talking about here, about the process of the body, that the work is never done. That's what the show, Bodies of Work, is really trying to frame, that the work is never done and that nothing is ever erased. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for inviting us.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks for structure, Janine.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.